So I'm going to read from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 5, Karma Yoga, Action in Krishna Consciousness, text number 29. Bhaktaram jagatapasam sarvalokamaheshwaram suridam sarvabhutanam kyatramam shantim richati. Person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Please repeat. Person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Purport. The conditioned souls within the clutches of illusory energy are all anxious to attain peace in the material world. But they do not know the formula for peace, which is explained in this part of the Bhagavad Gita. The greatest peace formula is simply this. Lord Krishna is the beneficiary of all human activities. Men should offer everything to the transcendental service of the Lord because he is the proprietor of all planets and the demigods thereon. No one is greater than he. He is greater than the greatest of the demigods, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. In the Vedas, Shveta Shvetara Upanishad 6.7, Supreme Lord is described as Tam Ishvaranam Paramam Maheshwaram. Under the spell of illusion, living entities are trying to be the lords of all they survey, but actually they are dominated by the material energy of the Lord. The Lord is the master of material nature, and the conditioned souls are under the stringent rules of material nature. Unless one understands these bare facts, it is not possible to achieve peace in the world, either individually or collectively. This is the sense of Krishna consciousness. Lord Krishna is the supreme predominator, and all living entities, including the great demigods, are his subordinates. One can attain perfect peace only in complete Krishna consciousness. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthai Bhutai Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvatundeve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Srinivadi Paskatyade Sitarana. This is the formula that Lord Krishna is giving for peace in the world. The Bhagavad Gita Krishna also says Nasti Buddhya Yuktasya Nachi Yuktasya Bhavanaha Na chabhavi yatak shantira ashantasya kutak sukham. Unless one is in transcendental consciousness, one can have neither a controlled mind nor a steady intelligence, without which there is no possibility of peace, and how can there be any happiness unless there is peace? In other words, unless we're peaceful, how can we become happy? And as long as we misidentify ourselves with this body, then how can we be peaceful? Because after all, one thing everyone has in common here is that we all have a material body. And one thing a material body does is that it grows old, it becomes diseased, and then it dies. So everyone has that same problem. Old age, disease, and death. And then, according to Bhagavad Gita at least, we go somewhere, and it may not be where we want to go. So these are all problems. And therefore, we're never very peaceful. Just like I've given the example here before, but we'll give an example again. Just like if we gave everyone here a free ticket to fly to India, or now it's going to be, we're in November, so the next one will be Gaur Purnim. So we gave everyone here a free ticket to fly to India for Gaur Purnim. How many of our guests here would accept a free two-way ticket to fly to India, to Mayapur for Gaur Purnim? Luckily, we have some wealthy devotees here, so just see them afterwards, and I'm sure they'll give you at least a ticket, one ticket. You can ask for two or three and see what happens. So just imagine we're on the airlines, Hare Krishna Airlines, and the pilot says, Hare Krishna. Welcome to Air Hare Krishna. We help you enjoy the flight. We have a 15-course meal that the devotees prepared of five sabjis with curd, gulab jamuns, halva, pizza, lasagna, and ice cream. 32 flavors from Kalachandri's restaurant. So we hope you enjoy the flight. There's also a movie of the Hare Krishnas in India taking prasadam during Gaur Purnim. It was nominated as one of the seven wonders of the world. The scientists were trying to figure out how did all that food fit into anyone's body. So we hope you enjoy the rest of the flight. Only one other brief announcement I just received, that the Hare Krishnas, although they paid for the prasadam, they didn't pay for the fuel, and therefore we only have half the amount of fuel necessary to reach India. So in a half an hour, we're going to crash into the ocean and you'll all be killed. But don't worry, because the Hare Krishnas have promised to serve out practically the whole feast before we crash. And we know you'll enjoy the rest of the flight, although it's a little briefer than we thought it was going to be. And also, we believe we can show you at least half the movie. And if you really like the movie, then we want to advise you to pray to Krishna so that you can come back and see the other half. So please enjoy the rest of the flight. Chant Hare Krishna, be happy. Enjoy your meal. The pilot and the co-pilot were bailing out now. So I hope everything goes nicely on automatic, and enjoy your lunch. Hare Krishna. So of course, some devotees will be very happy that there's such a nice feast. Many people lose their appetite. But we're all exactly in the same circumstances, because this body is our vehicle, and we know that either today or tomorrow or sometime in the future, it's going to crash. But in the meantime, we want to have a good time. But in the back of our minds, we're wondering, what's going to happen to me in the near future? Therefore, one cannot be actually peaceful. Yudhisthira Maharaj, a great devotee, was once asked by his father, who was in the form of a yaksha, what is the most amazing thing in this world? So Yudhisthira Maharaj said, Ahani ahani bhutani gacchanti amalayam shesha stavra ichchanti kemascharyam atatparam. The most amazing thing is that we see that at every moment so many living entities are entering to the jaws of death, but those who remain behind think that they're going to live here forever. Unfortunately, or it's not true that no one stays here forever, although we're trying to cover that fact over by so many different ways. People's minds are trying to be diverted, but ultimately that fact remains in the back of our consciousness. So the question is, according to Bhagavad Gita, if we're all eternal, because after all, Krishna says, we've had so many bodies already. It's not that death means a change of body, and that's something different, because we're already changing our bodies in so many different, at every moment we're getting a different body. So therefore death means simply another body. But the question is, why does the eternal soul get a temporary body? So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna answers that by saying it's because we're attempting to steal from Krishna. We become thieves, and therefore Krishna has us arrested by his illusory energy called Maya. Just like one time Prabhupada was walking on, here in Dallas, on during morning walk on White Rock Lake Park. You can find this conversation. It's in one of Satsrupa Maharaj's books. It used to be Prabhupada's short quotes. And there, the devotees were on the other side of Howard Hughes's place, and the devotees pointed out, here's the house of Howard Hughes, he's the richest man in the world, and we went to his house and we tried to sell him a Bhagavad Gita, or at least give him a Bhagavad Gita, I guess. He probably was too cheap to give a donation. But the guard stopped us at the gate and said, well, we'll give it to him. You can't see him. So Prabhupada asked the devotees, if you could have seen Howard Hughes, what would you have told him? So one devotee said, I would have told him we're model citizens and we're trying to help the community. Another one said, well, chant Hare Krishna and be happy. And that went on, and then Prabhupada said, no, if I would have seen him, I would have told him, my dear Howard Hughes, you've made so many billions of dollars by oil, but actually all that oil belongs to Krishna. So one day, Krishna's representatives will come and they'll chastise you and take you away. So you should give back all that stolen property to Krishna. So the devotees were quite surprised how strongly Prabhupada was preaching. And one day, Prabhupada had an opportunity to demonstrate that preaching during a morning walk in Mayapur on the roof of one building called the Long Building. Prabhupada was taking his morning walk there along with his disciples and many of the friends and life members of the movement. One devotee introduced to Prabhupada a life member, and he was all dressed in white khadi in the style of Nehru. And the devotee said, Prabhupada, here is Mr. So-and-so. He's the big industrialist. I'd like to introduce you. The brother said, oh, very nice to meet you, Hare Krishna. What do you do? He said, I'm an industrialist. I have many factories. I said, oh, how nice. And what do you manufacture? I manufacture glass. Oh, glass, how nice. Where does glass come from? Glass comes from sand. Oh, sand. Oh, how interesting. Where does sand come from? So the man was a little pious. He says, sand comes from Bhagavan. Oh, Bhagavan. Sand comes from Bhagavan. Oh, so you're stealing from Bhagavan. So the man was a little embarrassed, and he disappeared for the rest of the walk. Finally, he came back at the end of the walk very enthusiastically and said, Swamiji, Swamiji, I just want to tell you that I give in charity. So Prabhupada's eyebrows raised up and said, oh, so you give in charity. Oh, you're a little thief. And everyone laughed, including the man. In other words, if it is a fact that there is a God, then God is the proprietor of everything. And as long as we're trying to steal from God, then the result is we become arrested by his illusory energy and we're put into a material body and we're forced to misidentify ourselves with some body, and the body becomes our master and the soul becomes a slave. And although we work very hard for the body, still it just repays us with so much problems like old age, disease, and death. So of course, people have created a world where they imagine themselves to be the proprietors of so many things in this world. They've divided the world up, and they claim that this is America, and the Americans belong. America belongs to the Americans, because that's a joke also. And that England belongs to the English, whatever. So, this is all a mental concoction. But they've made so many laws that this belongs to me, this belongs to you, etc. The Prophet said it's just like a group of thieves. They get together and they rob a bank. And then after robbing the bank, the head thief stands up and tells all the other thieves, "My dear fellow thieves, you did a great job robbing the bank. Let's all glorify the thieves. 1, 2, 3. All glories to the thieves. But my dear fellow thieves, now that we've stolen all this money, let me request you, please, I beg of you, let's divide this money up honestly." So they're all thieves. They've stolen the money, and now they want to be honest thieves. So similarly, the basic principle of material existence is to steal from God and then try to divide the money up honestly. But the basic mentality is thievery. Therefore, it shouldn't be surprised, as Prabhupada said, or as his spiritual master said, that in modern society, there's two classes of people. The cheated and those who are cheated. Of course, those who are cheated are in the vast majority. There's only a few people clever enough to cheat everyone. And the vast majority want to be amongst the few people cheating everyone else. But it's just a society of the cheated and the cheated and the cheaters. But even the cheaters who are so expert, they're also being cheated because they're placed in the Bali concept of life and they have to suffer the same miseries everyone else is suffering. Although they suffer the material miseries in a much more comfortable bed. And when they die a lot more richer than anyone else. And all their wealth pays for their passage. They don't walk to hell. Yamaraj sends a jet plane for them. They go to hell first class. But of course, the whole illusion is based upon the fact they say the scientists have discovered there is no God. Therefore, we don't have to worry about God's police force because there is no God. We're all God. Or we could become God. Just I have to increase my salary a little bit. So they say there is no God, but why do they say there is no God? Just like if you doctor takes your pulse and he says it's completely normal. He takes your heartbeat, he says it's normal. He does a thorough medical examination and declares that everything he's found out so far is completely normal. And then you ask the doctor, "My dear doctor, what is your ultimate opinion about my state of health?" He takes your hand and says, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you, son, I think you're dead." So they look at the universe, they see so many wonderful things going on, planets moving their orbits exactly on time, the sun rising at appointed time, the sun setting its appointed time. We eat food, the food is assimilated, digested, assimilated, the unnecessary parts are eliminated. So many wonderful arrangements are going on, and what is their conclusion? Oh, God is dead. So actually, God is not dead, but their intelligence is dead. They come up with so many fantastic ideas, not even theories, just concocted ideas, that man has come from monkeys. Of course, maybe they came from monkeys. But that doesn't mean that everyone else had to come from a monkey. Because Prabhupada has summarized that in a very simple way. Just like if you trace your ancestry, because everyone had a father and mother, and everyone's father and mother had a father and mother, and if you go back far enough, you wouldn't expect that one of your great-great-grandfathers was a monkey. And then if you kept on tracing his ancestry back, you wind up and you find out that one of the ancestors of that monkey was a sheep, a black sheep, the black sheep that everyone in your family always talks about. And then tracing the black sheep's family ancestry back, you come to a mouse. Great-great-grandfather Squeaky. And if you trace that mouse's ancestry all the way back, you come to a rock. And then the rock, of course, came from nothing. So then there's a whole history of your family, how our ancient grandfather or nothing, his mother kept on bothering him all the time to become something. She just wouldn't leave him alone. So one day he did the best he could. He became a rock. But still, it wasn't good enough for Mother Nothing, because she felt her son was a failure. Although the most solid member of the family. Still, she kept on bothering him, so he became angry and exploded, flew in all different directions for millions of years. Finally, he settled down, and here we are now. So the story goes that Mr. Rock, he met Mrs. Rock, he fell in love, and they produced a mouse, which later on gave birth to a black sheep that no one wants to talk about. That's why you don't know so much about him. And finally, the monkey appeared in our family, swinging from our family tree. And here we are now. So, of course, this is taken as some kind of science, but actually it's only science fiction. It only exists in the imaginations of some rather unusual people. Unfortunately, those unusual people are in great numbers nowadays. But the fact is that the material universe of which we're aware of has been created with great intelligence. And therefore, when we find creations of great intelligence, we know there must be a great person with great intelligence behind it. Only out of enviousness and ignorance do people deny the existence of the great intelligence behind the universe. Even, I was reading one book that one devotee had produced, Rethinking Darwin, I think it's called. And there it explains that Darwin originally thought that the cell was just a mass of matter. There was no organization, it was just a mass of protoplasm. But when the scientists looked more carefully, when their instruments improved, they could actually see that each cell had divisions and organizations much more elaborate than any city. Like, one cell was much more elaborately designed than all of New York City, with its different systems of sanitation and transportation and energy distribution and elimination, that the cell was very complicated. And the very mechanism by which the cell would reproduce itself was beyond anyone's imagination. No one could create such a machine, so elaborate machine, so intricate machine, as it took for one cell to create another cell. Therefore, the probability of the cell coming about, even one cell by itself or by accident, was absolutely zero. But if you don't like something, then you just ignore it and hope it goes away, including the trillions and quadrillions of cells that just happen to hang around, because they don't fit very well into your theory, so you just ignore them. But this is actually not science, it's actually just another version of people's imagination. In other words, the most obvious things, like the fact that our bodies are changing, but we're not changing, we're the same person within the body, in spite of all the different changes. The very fact that the material universe is arranged in such an elaborate, intelligent way, people of so-called knowledge just choose to ignore, and they come up with the idea everything has come about by accident. But if everything has come about by accident, then why do they strive so hard to get what they want? If everything's just an accident, why don't they just stay at home and by accident they'll become millionaires? If everything's just an accident, why don't they stay at home and by accident they'll get their PhD degree? Why do they have to strive so hard to organize the world around them to get what they want, and yet the rest of the world just goes on by accident? It's because they don't really believe in their theory, but they just want everyone else to believe in it. Why do they do that? Well, because they get their PhDs by accident, or they get their Nobel Prizes by creating an accident theory. Otherwise, if everything is not by an accident, if there is actually a God who's controlling everything, there is actually, we're actually not God and we'll never become God. If we are eternal souls, then there are a whole so-called quest of science to become the supreme here to guarantee us that one day, if there is a heaven, as one, when I went to college, I studied behavioral modification. By one man, one scientist created this theory of psychology called behavioral modification. He said, one day we'll become so scientifically advanced that we'll break into heaven, we'll find the old man God, and we'll kill him, and we'll take his place. Nice man. In any case, with this kind of mentality, you can imagine that they're less than sympathetic with any idea of intelligence behind the universe, because they want to be the intelligence behind the universe, and they want to eliminate the competitor, not by anything reasonable, but just by trying to ignore him and hope that he goes away. Maybe he'll get very old and he'll die and then they can take his place. But this is all just imagination. Unfortunately, imagination has become like common sense. Or imagination is the opposite of common sense. Common sense nowadays is very uncommon, but imagination has become very common. But the Christian consciousness movement is simply presenting something very simple, and for those who are simple, they can appreciate how simply we're not the body, and simply there's a supreme person who is in charge of the universe who could actually free us from this illusion if we follow his instructions. Namely, to give up this false idea that we're here to control the universe and ignore his presence. So in this age, when everything is very complicated and people have to struggle just for ordinary peace of mind, therefore Krishna has given a very simple way of gradually awakening our dormant consciousness of ourselves and the Supreme Person just by chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So if we do that, in spite of all the different obstacles that seem to be on our path of making spiritual improvement, still the Hare Krishna mantra is so powerful that all the illusions that are confronting us will simply evaporate if we, as much as we pay attention to the chanting. Just like if you light a match in a dark room, then the darkness can't put the match out. So similarly, if we concentrate on chanting Hare Krishna with the feeling of accepting Krishna as the Supreme, then all the ignorance which is being presented to us now and has been presented to us in the past will just evaporate, just like darkness evaporates as soon as the light is there. So it's so powerful. So, thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yes. Oh. Any questions? Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Actually, I enjoyed your lecture very much. It was very scientifically oriented also. I hope you are also from a science background, I believe. Maybe you learned a lot of natural science or something like
Unfortunately.
But
I remember taking my classes in physics. The theory at that time is that one year they taught us light was a wave, and the next year they taught it was a particle. And then they decided it was a wavicle.
Actually, we have to say that we are getting better in understanding. But in certain
yes, gradually we're finding out that the scientists are fools.
But you are, I think, strongly against the Darwinism, I think, right?
He's not one of my favorites. At least not his theory. Of course, they're trying to figure out what is his theory. Because he wasn't really sure what his theory was either.
There's something, maybe a missing link or something on the evolutionary path.
Yeah, probably so the missing link is my foot kicking you in the head.
But somebody has to define that, right? Maybe nobody.
Yeah, he had some idea that somehow or another in the future, they'll, by examining the fossil record, they'll find all the missing links. But unfortunately, they didn't find anything. They just found out he was wrong. But that didn't deter them because they're very enthusiastic.
We should appreciate them also. Right?
What's that?
I'm saying we should appreciate that kind of interest in people to find what is behind.
Yeah, they're very determined. Just like the road to hell is lined with sincerity. So they're certainly, we can give them credit. Generally, people had to walk to hell before, but now they want to take a jet plane there.
Thank you.
Is there any benefit to helping people understand the subtle sciences? They're right now occupied with the gross material stuff. If we start getting into the subtle stuff, which does happen to include the karmic stuff, is there any benefit to them in terms of opening people's eyes to a greater universe? And
well, they may, by the time their eyes are open, they may have be their next. They may get their next pair of eyes, and they may not be human eyes.
But if it becomes a cultural thing, then the children grow up with it, and they at least have a sense of
maybe. But many people should understand the laws of karma, and the reincarnation. That's all part of the spiritual science. People should understand it. Because ultimately, along with the law of karma, there must be a lawgiver. So that's all part of the spiritual science. So that's necessary. Even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada mentions that the Brahmins in the Vedic culture, they learn in their Gurukul, they learn astrology and Ayurveda. And they go to door and they enlighten people with this knowledge of Ayurveda, they deal with their illnesses, and they tell them something about the future. And that way people have some faith in the Brahminical culture. So that's nice. Then they'd find out that actually there is a next life. And by finding out there is a next life, they become a little concerned what their next life would be. Yes.
Hare Krishna, thank you for the wonderful class. Maharaj, actually all of us are sons of Krishna. And as a father, he loves us all. So what exactly happens to those who never accept Krishna? What exactly happens at the end? Can you please?
At the end of what?
Like cycle, and then they just...
Well, there's cycle. They keep on going on. We've been here for a long time. Krishna doesn't interfere with our free will. This is like a playground. If the children here are really attached to the playground, he lets them stay and play as long as they want. And it's a big playground. But ultimately, he gives them a rest. There's a creation of the universe, and there's annihilation, and then there's a recreation, just to give everyone a rest. So this can go on. It's gone on since time immemorial, and it can keep on going on from time immemorial from now. People seem just as enthusiastic to enjoy the material world as when it started. They never give up. So that's the power of Maya. This time it will be different. Although it's the same thing over and over again, but this time we think we're actually going to be able to enjoy.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you for teaching this class. My question is related to something you just said about the children being allowed to be on the playground as long as they'd like. Is it possible for the children to destroy the playground?
Well, we seem to be doing a pretty good job at it.
That was my question. And how do you think that relates to scientists or people who believe in science?
Well, they do a lot.
Analyze that.
Well, most of, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, those who don't believe in God, who think everything is coming about by accident, who think that they're the controllers, generally, due to their misunderstanding of things, they wind up creating horrible, unbeneficial works which are meant to destroy the world. So as soon as you do better than the person who does everything perfectly, then whatever you do is going to be less than perfect. So, in the name of creating a better society, they've actually made a mess of things.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Prabhuji, I have one question. Like, when we are spiritual souls and when we get another body, why don't we remember our past life?
Some people do, at least for some time. There are many people on record who do. But we can't remember what we did yesterday. Especially in Kali Yuga, our memories are very short.
Guruji, like my question is, like if you don't remember our past things, like if I'm in a school, if I don't remember what I did in my last semester or last class, then how can I proceed further? So to go ahead, I have to remember what I have learned so far. Isn't that true?
Not necessarily. I mean, basically the lesson should be, don't take another body, surrender to God. But according to our karma, we're presented with different associations. If we're fortunate, we're presented with good association, will help us remember God and our relationship with God. And if we're not, we're presented with association, which is encouraging us to forget God and forget our relationship with God. Therefore, we do remember, but our remembrance is being misdirected, that's all. Away from God rather than towards God. So that's our misfortune. Unless we are fortunate enough to come into good association, which can redirect our lives back to something more meaningful.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Thank you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you so much for this wonderful class. The title of today's verse was Krishna Karma Yoga in Krishna Consciousness. I have this question for some time now. I wish to understand the difference between Karma Kand, Karma Yoga, Karma Yoga in Krishna Consciousness, and Bhakti Yoga.
Well, Kamarkanda is the... as soon as you do that, you stand between me and the person who asked the questions. Unless you want to ask the same question. Karmakanda means the part of the Vedas which deal with the working in the material world according to the Veda construction in order to get some... in order to get some favorable circumstance in the material world in the future. So that means we're going to change one material circumstance, hopefully for a better material circumstance. Karma yoga means to do those same activities, but to do them in such a way as to all simultaneously link us up with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And karma yoga in Krishna consciousness means not only to do things which will link us with Krishna, but to actually be linked by becoming aware of Krishna. Be able to see how Krishna is in everyone's heart and everyone is actually Krishna's eternal servant. And that's part of the process of bhakti yoga. In other words, when you add awareness, knowledge to karma yoga, then you become karma yoga action in Krishna consciousness. You not only act, but you actually act for Krishna, and therefore you become aware of Krishna. And therefore, by becoming aware of Krishna, by experiencing Krishna, when that becomes full, then you develop love for Krishna or bhakti.
So bhakti yoga and karma yoga and Krishna consciousness are to some extent same?
Yeah, karma yoga, action, Krishna consciousness, that is part of bhakti yoga. It's part of it. But bhakti yoga is the full yoga, where one is actually has awakened his love for Krishna. That's called buddhi yoga.
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you so much.
So we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande.